Hey friend, welcome to Houston Made, a show where I, Rusty Gates, get to talk with local Houston-based entrepreneurs and business owners about what it's like to be in the middle of that journey and selfishly gain insights as I build my own business. In this episode, I got to talk with my very good friend, Bob Sutton, the co-owner and founder of Statesman Beverage Company, a company that makes fantastic simple syrups that make having a craft cocktail at home super simple. Bob is actually one of my best friends, but before that, he was actually my boss, giving me my first job here in Houston. And then whenever I got into real estate, he was one of my first clients. And I've also traveled across the state to markets selling simple syrup for Statesman with him. And you'll hear all of that and more in our conversation for sure. Today's episode is sponsored by Victoria Garcia Studios, a local full-service photography studio that specializes in personal brand photography. If you're a business owner or an entrepreneur, having purposeful brand photography can make all the difference in your ability to connect with your target demographic. So stay tuned after the episode to learn how Victoria Garcia Studios can help you stand out in your industry through high-quality, on-brand photography. Now listen in as Bob and I discuss how Statesman was born out of a Thanksgiving rejection, why he decided to bring on a business partner right away, and lessons from selling in markets, including charging what you're worth. This is a disclaimer in ways. I had never listened to an episode of How I Built This, ever.
Not one.
I get it. You've been recommending it for years, and along with Sam and many, many other people. And I'd never listened to it, not because I wasn't interested. I felt like, yeah, that's really cool. I probably want to listen to that. And I never did. So I pulled the trigger. And then like kind of leading up to this week, I thought, well, now I'm at this divergence on this path of, okay, well, do I listen to it so that I know like, okay, that's what they do and I do or do not want to do that? Or do I not listen to it? Because if I do listen to it, maybe I'll just try to rip it off completely.
Right. Yeah.
Be like, it'd be too influenced by it. So I ended up listening to half an episode.
Oh, okay.
So I listened to half an episode.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I probably in your shoes, this being this close to recording, I probably wouldn't have too, yeah. Just simply for like, I don't want to inadvertently copy, yeah. Some technique or
totally
whatever.
The encouraging thing to me was that I think Guy and I live on very different energy levels. Like I think that our energy levels are very different. So I don't think there's much of a chance that I'm going to get all soft and whispery. I think that the way that Guy at least did in the episode I was listening to. And then the other part of it too, is that as I think through Houston Made podcast and who I want to talk to and what I want to do. Well, I had interviewed in the first episode, I interviewed Luke Bronner, who is kind of the, I guess, director, we would say, of Milieu Media, the podcast network where this will live. And one of the things he said is that, and I'll just quote him, I think what we all want is to have conversations with people we admire about things in which we're mutually interested, and that podcasting allows you to do that. And so when I think about this, like that was like, oh yeah, that was exactly it. That's exactly what this is. This is an opportunity and an excuse for me to talk to people I admire about something that we're mutually interested in, which is in this case, being a business owner and entrepreneur in Houston right now. And I think one of the big things that I differentiated between How I Built This and what I'm making here with Houston Made is that I want to talk to people who are in the middle of it, right? As opposed to, and not to say that anybody's ever arrived, but those companies, they've kind of arrived. Like they kind of made it.
You've got a $1 billion valuation.
You're good. Yeah, I get it. You may be in progress, but I think it's gravy at that point. And so my goal is, right, to talk to people who are just doing it, who maybe are doing it full-time, who maybe aren't, who have been doing it at least for some little bit of time to have something to say on the topic and then just share like, okay, well, how's that going? What have you learned? And really, again, a lot of that comes from the fact that I carry regularly a fair amount of imposter syndrome about being a business owner, quote unquote. And yet I am. I have a business account. It has money in it. It pays my bills. Mm-hmm. I sure as hell pay taxes as a business owner does and would. And so then I just want to talk to these other people, hear about what you do. Maybe it's very, very different from what I do in real estate as a business owner. And yet I'm sure there are principles that apply. And I'm sure that my suspicion is that some of the experiences are very much the same. Mm. So
yeah,
that's all I want to do. And cool. I'm glad to have you here and glad to pick your brain and hear about Statesman and your journey. Well, okay, we'll just jump right into all of this. So thank you so much for being here, Bob Sutton, the CEO, right?
Yeah.
Of Statesman Beverage Company. Tell me a little bit about Statesman and then we'll kind of go from there. Just so if no one's heard of it, what is it?
Yeah. Statesman Beverage Company is it's a 4-year-old company that was founded out of a desire to make cocktails and basically to empower home bartenders to make like mixologist quality drinks with quality ingredients. And so 4 years ago, my business partner, Holly, and I decided that we were going to give it a try and try to make some money doing something fun. And we've basically grown from one store in the Woodlands that carried us. They were our first retailer, and us doing, you know, little markets in church parking lots to, I think we're at 107 or 108 stores now in 31 states. The largest stores are Williams-Sonoma and Specs. And we've somehow survived 4 years. And I know a lot of companies don't make it past the 1 or 2 year mark. And even through the pandemic, we turned a profit last year, which is we're very thankful for. So yeah,
everybody was drinking. Like it was just
it's true. It's just like drinking at home was a popular activity.
Yeah. Again, the pandemic's awful and it's been awful for a lot of people. And yet, you know, with people being trapped at home, your product really ends up being perfect for people who want to have some of that bar experience, but don't know what they're doing. So essentially you've got right now, at least from the public's perspective, a couple of simple syrups that you use in cocktails. I lean towards the Sir Winston's Spice Simple Syrup,
yep,
which can be make a lot of drinks, but kind of focused on making a really good classic old fashioned with the syrup, bourbon, and a garnish if you want it.
Yeah.
So that makes life easy whenever you want to drink. And I know I've gone through a couple of bottles because it's like, well, I want to have a cocktail, but I don't want to dirty a whole bunch of dishes. This is the laziness in me. And then also I want something that tastes good that is not just bourbon. And this is a great middle ground for that. You talked about how when you guys said, well, 4 years ago, we're going to give it a go and we're going to try to start a business and maybe make some money with this syrup. That wasn't really the beginning of it, right? Where did the syrup making begin for you?
That started, I can't remember the exact number of years ago now. It's between 9 and 10. It was Thanksgiving. I was kind of at a stage where, you know, I wanted to contribute more to my family Thanksgiving. I mean, it was aunts and uncles and grandparents and my family, brothers and sisters. And so I offered, you know, several weeks in advance, what can I bring? My mom had sent around an email just saying, you know, who wants to make potatoes this year? Yeah, whatever. And I volunteered. I was like, what can I, you know, what can we bring? And the ladies in my family refused to allow me to make food. So, it was more or less my mom or my grandmother's decision to say, why don't you bring a drink? Rather than trust me with,
and they were thinking like a bottle of wine.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
It was not mixed drinks. I ended up, I had a sangria recipe that was pretty complicated that called for a simple syrup and one that had some spice to it. And so, I made the simple syrup and then made the sangria the day before and brought it and my family loved it. I mean, it was great. And so did the same thing the next year and it kind of became a tradition. And for, you know, 3 or 4 years, I kind of would do the same thing, but then I'd tweak the simple syrup a little bit, change up the spices. After, I think it was 4 or 5 years, I ended up deciding like, okay, like what's the main ingredient of simple syrup? It's sugar. And so I went out and scoured to find the best flavored sugars and best quality that I could find.
Yeah.
And ended up making more and got all organic spices that year and ended up making a pretty large batch. Well, way more than I needed for the sangria that year. And so ended up bottling, you know, put it in 3 or 4 bottles and gave it around to friends. And I took it up to the office where, you know, we had a bar cart and people could try it out and got nothing but positive feedback. And so basically just sat on it again for another 12 months and decided I'm just going to play with this. The next year, which would have been 2016, I think, I made about, it was probably 3 or 4 gallons of this simple syrup. I put it in bottles and then took those bottles around to friends and told everybody, you know, hey, I'm selling this stuff, made a really funny sticker. you know, and ended up selling all 25 bottles. And at, you know, it really, at that point, it was like, okay, like at first I thought it was a joke. Like at first I thought, you know, this is something I'm doing for fun. Will people actually pay to, you know, have this product? And then when people came back after they finished their bottle and said, can I get some more?
Yeah.
At that point I knew like, okay, this actually is a thing. Like it can stand on its own. It's not just me convincing my friends to pay me $15 for, you know, a bottle. It was started to get some real good positive feedback that it wasn't just a favor that was people were doing for me. A great friend who I worked with at the time is a brilliant marketer, Holly. And so somehow convinced her to join me. I knew that I needed a business partner, someone to bounce ideas off of and kind of take some of the stress load, because it was going to be a part-time kind of side hustle for both of us. And so she agreed to partner with me and we officially formed the company in the early part of 2017. So yeah, that's the origin story.
Yeah.
Was basically being refused, you know, the ability to bring Thanksgiving dinner. So started making cocktails.
That'll work. Yeah. I mean, it's a good alternative. I mean, otherwise you might have a pie business right now. Who knows?
It's true. It could be Sir Winston's Pie or Statesman Pie Co. But,
and I bet you could probably make a pretty good pie with some Sir Winston's. I bet apples and some syrup and you got most of it done.
You might be onto something. We'll talk after forming another entity.
So you get some traction. People like it. It seems like, okay, maybe they want to buy this more than just once a year. And they're not just being nice and saying, okay, fine, here's $15. And then you go to Holly, who, again, great, brilliant marketer who has now started another business of her own. What was it in you that made you think, I know you mentioned sharing some of the stress load, but it seems like pretty instinctually right away, you're like, I need somebody else to bring in. What led you to that conclusion? And was there any fear in you around, well, I don't want to give this away? Because it seems like you jumped into it right away.
Yeah. So a part of it came from back in my early 20s, I was a freelance photographer, worked for myself, you know, had my own LLC, had a great friend who was a photographer who lived in Atlanta. I was in Dallas at the time. And we had talked about going into business together. We did a lot of, you know, shoots together, but we didn't actually work at the same company, because through that time, I realized how much I not only needed or craved kind of the feedback of having someone else on my team, but the stresses of going solo in an entrepreneurial way. I'm very much am a team decision maker, and also a verbal processor. So I need somebody to bounce ideas off of. I also had very little experience with sales, and that's something that Holly had a lot of experience with. And so me being more of the production and operations mind, I knew I needed someone who was as outgoing and charismatic as Holly is, to kind of not be the face of the business, but definitely be the one who's going to pioneer into new channels. There was a little bit of fear about giving up ownership, but that was quickly overcome by realizing that, like, at the moment I was giving up, literally nothing. I was giving up air,
responsibility. Yeah.
But that if it was going to grow, it was going to grow because of both of our efforts. And I couldn't have got it to where it is today on my own. I know that. So in retrospect, no regrets about bringing in a partner.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting to know, I mean, your limitations and obviously your photography business probably taught you a lot about that. Because so this obviously isn't your first gig or your first side hustle. And to have that self-awareness to know, okay, I just know, my bet is you probably could have gotten some success. You could have done some markets. You could have shown up and all of that. But I think you would have hit your ceiling probably pretty quickly. And you knew that. It's something that I think about a lot because, right, when I got into real estate, it was a lot of that was very much around the idea of I want to be my own boss and I want to do this on my own. One, to prove that I could. So there was a little bit of maybe ego in that for me, but also just I needed to build that confidence to say I can do this on my own. And I wanted all of my success or failure to be on my own shoulders. So if I failed, I wanted to know, like, okay, that means work harder. I think I needed to maybe just mature a little bit, and then becoming a business owner's helped that. And then as I've gotten more successful, the more and more I see my own limitations and I say, okay, I've got a lot of strengths around maybe creativity or again, being a kind of a hyper outgoing person. And yet there's some very real logistical issues that I struggle through. Mm-hmm. And so I know going into 2021, one of my big goals is really to give away as much of my business as possible to say, how can I bring people in, whether it's part-time, full-time, on like a retainer or a per situation deal that can just offload all of this to let those things shine. So it's cool to hear your perspective on that. Because the fear then is it has always been, if I give something away, I now no longer have necessarily control over it. I can't make it exactly how I want it, which may or may not be the best way, but it's just that like craving for control. Yeah. Have you guys had to deal with conflict through that of, I know you mentioned being a group decision maker, but when you have two of you, so when you disagree, how do y'all work that out?
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, you know, we worked together for 4 years before we formed the company together as, you know, as peers. And so, I think we have a very healthy conflict dynamic. You know, we definitely do butt heads and often we disagree on the best way to go on certain decisions. And I want to say most of the time, 95% of the time or more, the best idea wins because, you know, she's a very smart person and I'm okay. And so, we both come to it, basically reason wins, but yeah, we also do have kind of a healthy, like, you know, we don't take ourselves too seriously, but we want the very best for the company. So
you work through it.
Any co-business owners, you know, are going to experience some kind of conflict. And, I think it's mainly finding someone that you like working with and then can work through conflict with, and that's the basis of a healthy business relationship. So
yeah, you're both committed to the success of the thing, and that's the most important thing,
right?
That makes sense. So you're getting started pretty much right out of the gate. You bring in a partner and you guys just hit the road, like you said, markets, church parking lots, all of that. What was the first moment in your mind, if there was one, that you felt like, oh, like this is working?
Yeah. Don't want to say that it didn't start as fast as you might think. So back when we actually formed the LLC in March, but we didn't have our first market until September.
Okay.
We didn't start selling until September. And it was during that 5-6 month period that kind of the realities of a consumer packaged goods company bringing a food product to market. I mean, that was the deepest education that, you know, that I got, you know, the whole time we've had this company, that was the most intense period where I was learning about food safety and food safety testing and FDA approved labels. And we hired a brilliant graphic designer to do our labels and our logo and kind of all of our branding. And so it was all, you know, lots of setup. There was a good period there before we sold a single bottle as a legal entity that it was just like, well, I hope this works. You know, like, I hope my friends weren't lying. We had both invested some significant money into the project. And then, so it was actually our very first market was in September, and it was in a church parking lot in, you know, really small. I mean, there were probably like 10 tents total, 10 vendors. And I think we may have sold like $300 that day after paying $120 for the booth. But the fact that we sold $300 in one day was like mind blowing. Yeah. You know, it was such a small but significant moment of like, this is a, I don't know. It was the continual realization that this is a viable business. This is a viable product. You know, we gave samples and all that kind of stuff so people could try it before they actually bought it, and people tried it and then they bought it, which was just amazing. Our second market was actually more expensive, ended up being just a huge flop.
Oh no.
And we spent I think $300 or $400, $500 on the booth. It was a 3-day market, and we sold maybe $150 over the course of 3-day weekend. But fortunately, we were positioned right next to this guy who sold soaps, handmade soap. His name's Lewis. And Lewis noticed how pitiful we were, that our pricing was all scattered and didn't make sense for markets. And so he kind of took us under our wing, and every chance he got, he came over to our booth and kind of just downloaded information on best practices for markets and how to price your items and what your display should look like. Yeah, it was worth the pain of losing money that weekend for the education that we got from Lewis. I will say since then, I mean, we had some other unsuccessful markets, but that really turned a corner as far as us understanding the market community and how to really engage well with customers in a market setting.
Yeah. It feels like the market setting where people do their little pop-up tents and they sell their soap or their t-shirts or their stickers or whatever it is that they're selling is, I mean, maybe in the last 10 years has become a big deal.
Yeah.
I remember there were farmers markets growing up, and you go to a farmer's market to get vegetables,
right?
Maybe bread, some eggs, like it was for food. And now it feels like here in Houston, when there's not a pandemic, there are 12 markets going on every weekend, at least. I mean, you go from one kind of little neighborhood to another and there's another market. So they're getting increasingly popular. And I think it makes sense as entrepreneurship becomes, it feels like it's becoming a little bit of the American ideal. And it's never been easier to start something. And because of the internet and our phones and cameras and everything, we can all market our own stuff easily. So since more and more people are entering into that space, I mean, what advice do you have for people who are looking, whether it's t-shirts, soap, whatever, what advice do you have for people who are looking to maybe start selling something at the market square?
Yeah. Probably the two easiest pieces of advice that came from Lewis's, you know, Lewis's advice to us was, number one, price your things so they are, so the transaction is fast.
Okay.
You know, that was something that we learned the hard way. You know, you don't sell something for $14.85 at a market and then charge tax and then have to deal. No one wants to deal with change, especially coins. No one wants that. And so sell in increments of 10 or 20. Dollars. So just so someone can walk up, because so many people do use cash. A lot of people now, I guess, more than, you know, more people carry cards to go to markets for pandemic reasons. But just the quickness of the transactions, you know, you lose the opportunity to sell to the person behind the person you're talking to. You know, be kind and casual and chat with people, but don't lose the sale because you're trying to dig through and find pennies and this is the bottom of your change drawer or whatever. Yeah. That was a big mistake. The second is, especially for, you know, crafted goods, anything that's custom made, but you know, that's not made in China in mass production. There's real value to American made. There's value to Texas made, Houston made, small businesses. I've actually gone around to at different markets and basically told people, like, you need to be charging three times as much for what you have. Asher Castillo, you know, mm-hmm. he has been making these custom wood pieces, tables and candle holders and all this stuff for several years. And I remember telling him, the first time I saw him at a market, he was selling some very, very beautiful piece for like maybe $25.
Oh my gosh.
And I just remember saying, like, that should be $170. And I know that the product itself, it didn't cost him $170 to make.
Yeah.
Of course not. You know, he's got to make money. But just really valuing custom pieces, if there's a design element to it, really price yourself for what you're price yourself to actually make money.
Yeah.
And I think that's an area that, especially in small markets, and entrepreneurs can benefit from charging a little bit more. People maybe know that because they want to make money, but the confidence of, like, yeah, no, if you've got a quality product, charge for quality, because people care more about quality than they do getting garbage product for cheap.
Huge thank you to Bob Sutton. This is actually just the first half of our conversation. So if you want to hear more from Bob, be sure to tune in next week where we discuss the beauty of creating something new, saying no to opportunities that may hurt the integrity of the business we've built, and advice for those looking to start their own thing. In the meantime, go show Bob some love by buying some of his simple syrup. This is a product, all of them, he has three simple syrups, and I love them all. They're all fantastic. So go check them out on their website, statesmanbeverage.co, or you can find them on Instagram at statesmanbevco. Go get some. It's fantastic. This episode is sponsored by Victoria Garcia Studios. Victoria runs an amazing photography company right here in Houston that specializes in personal brand photography. Not only does she offer brand shoots that include everything from creative direction to wardrobe, hair, and makeup, but she also helps entrepreneurs develop unique visions for their photography through resources like her Brand Foundations Worksheet and Visual Aesthetics Cheat Sheet, which are offered for free on her website. I've personally worked with Victoria, and it was a fantastic experience. She helped me come up with the types of shots we needed, what locations would be best, and help coordinate the whole day. But most importantly, she produced epic photos that perfectly represented my brand and captured my unique personality. So whether you're a real estate agent like me, someone just starting to build a brand, or you've built a multi-million dollar company, head over to victoriagarciastudios.com to book your call and see how she can take your brand to the next level. As with all kinds of small businesses, every bit of support goes a long way. So take a moment to rate, review, and share Houston Made with that one person you know who might be interested. Houston Made is hosted by me, Rusty Gates, produced and edited in collaboration with Luke Bronner. Our artwork was designed by Stephanie Leal and Sarah Alwegfi in collaboration with Mac Ryan Creative. Credit for our theme music goes to Old Friends, New Friends. Houston Made is glad to be a part of the Milieu Media neighborhood of podcasts and storytellers. We are people who care deeply about human connection, and in our neighborhood, we find that connection by hearing and appreciating one another's stories and by sharing our own. To find more shows made by amazing storytellers from all kinds of backgrounds, visit milieumedia.com.